This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday, December 6th version of the DRF Players Podcast, show 194, as we inch incrementally closer to our 200th show. And the technology on this show, some of you have commented on in the past, it's sort of ever-evolving, ever-changing. On the plus side, this is our first show going out not only via the magic of Spreaker and our usual podcasting channels, but also on Facebook Live. So welcome to anybody who finds us on there. We appreciate having you. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, joined today, I think, in the end, it's a bit of a long shot, but I think in the end, I am going to be joined by both members of the usual crew. That's a little bit up to Mike Hogan, coming to us from the DRF offices in New York. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well. It's up to me. That's news to me.
Well, it's up to you in that I was figuring I would let you control the potential Skype call edition of our next guest.
Yes. Easy enough. If he's available, I can loop him in.
Give him a whirl. We're talking, of course, about the third member of the podcast, usual crew, Jonathan Kinchin. Jonathan, accomplished handicapper, NHC Tour champion last year. And one of the things that Jonathan is adept at in his handicapping is looking at various trips that horses have received in their previous runs and making upgrades or downgrades based on those trips. Expert trip handicapper, JK. Anytime you want to talk to him about trips, he's game for it. But today, I'm not sure if it's a horse's trip we need to worry about. JK, what's going on with you?
Man, you talk about a bad trip. This is like one for the ages. Hopefully my audio is appropriate. I'm on my phone. I had to make an emergency redirect for taking the little guy to school today. Not only did we have to make the redirect, it wasn't planned. There was also a flat tire. and then after the flat tire, there's great news. Okay, we kind of got out a little bit. We tipped out. We got the hole opened up on the rail, and we got the good news that it's Discount Tire's fault. They're going to replace the tire for free. So we're inside on the rail, and then right when we look like we found the gap, we get shut off again and realize that the only exit that we need is closed. So then we still bull our way out. We tip out. We get up to win, and we find out there's an inquiry. We get taken down. It's been a universal bad trip. I'm gonna be 4-5 next time, guaranteed.
Rock of Gibraltar's trip in the Breeders' Cup Mile has nothing on you, JK. But we appreciate you you persevering anyway, dropping in class to the phone connection, and joining us whilst driving around in Texas. I'll be kind. I won't ask you any quick questions. I'll make sure to give you time to mute and unmute. If you need to go dark for 45 seconds or a minute at any time, just give me some sort of heads up or text me, and we'll try to protect you and keep things going. But I do appreciate the Herculean effort to make it on our show today, show number 194 of the DRF Players Podcast. Lots of stuff to talk about, actually. Sort of a quiet time of the year. Last year at this time, I think we went to just a one show a week format for a while. Part of that had to do with my traveling as well. That was also before JK joined us here as a regular member of the podcast crew. But this year we're going to do the two shows. It looks like we're going to be in a nice rhythm. Tuesday 11, Friday 11, talking Eastern time. And the shows will be live. So you can join us via Spreaker, via Facebook Live. We're going to have a lot of fun. JK, since we have you, and since the way your day is going, it wouldn't surprise me if we lose you at some point. I'm going to start off with a little bit of tournament talk. News out of Florida from the weekend. Garrett Skiba, friend of the podcast, we've had him on here before, and perhaps we should have him on again soon, makes, I don't know if technically you can call it handicapping contest history, but he's having a year that's just unbelievable. Not only did he win the Belmont Betting Challenge, not only did he run second in the Kentucky Derby equivalent, a top 10 finish in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, and now with a $400 exacta in the last race, he wins the Conquer the Crown contest. JK, your thoughts on Mr. Skiba and the year he's had?
Man, I saw your post that he won, and I just tweeted, you know, I think his name is at multi-wagers or multi-wagers or something like that. But
at multi-wagers. He's a good follow on Twitter, too, for folks.
I just wrote machine because it's impressive. Those are, you know, I'm proud of the year I had last year. It was, yeah, I had a, you know, it was cool. I did, you know, Hawthorne win, the Gulfstream win, the online win. But, like, that's all great and everything. But, like, he's hitting the trifecta in, like serious events, like our biggest events, he's doing really well in. The Belmont one, the Derby one, he won the Gulfstream one, you know, so it's pretty impressive. You know, I'm starting to figure out a little bit about his game, and I look forward to sitting down with him and chatting with him a little bit more, but it feels like, and maybe I'm wrong about this, you might have a better idea, but it feels like all these tournaments he does well in, it always ends up to be some, like, really big straight bet that he hit, and I'm feeling like he uses his bullets, his dollars like bullets. I've heard someone talk about it kind of like that with tournament play in poker, where you don't treat it like money, you just treat it like bullets. And as long as you have enough left and you just got to hit once, and that's all that matters. Hit your target one time. And I feel like maybe, I don't know if it's just maybe late in the day, that's what he's kind of turned his game into, or if his entire approach is $400 cold exactas and he's wrong, and he's right. So either way, it's been pretty impressive.
I'm not going to give away the store here, but I do have a detailed interview with Garrett that I conducted that I haven't posted yet. We're going to get that up and running probably tomorrow on DRF.com as part of my tournament coverage there that you can also access via DRF Tournament's website at tournaments.drf.com under the news dropdown. So that'll be on there, and I think we should have him on to discuss it. Few things I wanted to discuss, JK. Bit of a political question, so you might want to put your politician's hat on before you answer this one. What do we think, and you know, perhaps Chris Larmy would be a good person to have on to talk about this as well, but what do we think about the way that the NHC Tour is designed? Obviously, part of what they're looking to do is fuel revenue. That's only fair. And they do that by trying to make online events a huge piece of it. And the way the scoring system works, you get all these points for finishing well, as you did last year, multiple occasions, in nearly full online events. You really don't get that many points if you're Garrett, relatively speaking, putting up these large amounts of money, arguably helping the overall, not arguably, inarguably, helping the game as a whole a lot more by participating in these live bank contests, turning over large amounts of money. But the field size, you know, a contest like Gulfstream, not anything terrible, but, you know, 62 players as opposed to 210 in the online event on Sunday. I guess what I'm trying to say is, should Garrett's achievements be worth more in the context of the NHC Tour? He's too much of a grown-up to whine about it. I tried to prod him to get him to give me something controversial. But I'll ask you, JK, should these achievements be worth more?
Well, there's the good news. The good news is our friends at the NTRA, and I can speak to it specifically because there's been a change that involved something that I was dear to me, is that when there's a problem, they'll listen and they'll try to fix it. There's certain things I think people want them to fix that just isn't possible. If you don't like it, go play a different game. But I think one of the things that I'll be recommending to the powers that be when I'm able to kind of rub shoulders next month is, I believe that the online points should be based on participation, how many people are playing in the tournament. If you win a 500-person online tournament, then you should kind of get rewarded for that. However, when it comes to the live bankroll tournaments, the live tournaments, it feels like the buy-in amount should be the weighted version of that. For instance, if you participate in...
I love that.
No offense. If you participate in the $150, $200, $300 live bankroll tournament at my favorite tournament, by all means, with this said first, is like Hawthorne, you shouldn't get the same amount of tour points if you win the 40-person, you know, Kentucky Derby betting challenge where you bought in for 20 grand. It should carry more weight the more dollars that you're spending on it. And the thing is that I get why they do that. They have to fuel the participation with the tour. That's why the tour was invented. How do we get people to keep playing after they double qualify? Well, we dangle this in front of them to continue participation, which is great. I love the idea. It's perfect. It needs to be there. But there needs to be a way where, you know, these live bankroll tournaments are the tracks love them. And if you can get more people to participate because there's more of a tour advantage, then I feel like the racetracks will reward by buying more seats, and it'll just be a good situation for everybody. So I think that's something they should probably look at. And like I said, it's something that I'll mention when I see Chris Larmy, who is on the players committee. Paul Sherman's on the players committee. Michelle Ravencraft, who's always open to listening to ideas on what they can do to improve the NHC, and Keith Chamblin as well. So when I have the opportunity, those are things that I'll suggest. And I'm sure there's a lot of things about it that make it a lot more complicated than I'm just making it seem like it is. But at least it's an idea that can be worked with.
They're so good at coming up with good compromises on these things, JK. And maybe it's hard to make those tournaments worth more than anything else based on the participation. But they certainly shouldn't be worth less. You know what I mean? The Gulfstream tournament shouldn't be worth less than the Hawthorne tournament to me. That just seems logical. And perhaps there's a way to level the scales. Mike Hogan, as somebody who's neutral in all this, with your relationship with DRF prevents you from playing in a lot of tournaments yourself. But, I mean, do you, as an outsider looking at the NHC Tour, what's your view on this idea that, as presently constructed, the big money tournaments are worth so much less in tour terms than a lower buy-in event like the Hawthorne contest that JK won last year?
Well, you know, I think Jonathan brings up a really good point, and you think about it in terms of other sports, golf leaderboards, even in horse racing. I mean, you look at who has the most earnings, either by horse or jockey or trainer, and it's weighted on the bigger races. The bigger events are worth more naturally than the second level allowance at Aqueduct on a Friday. And I think that, the sport needs all of it. It's all valuable, but certainly some, especially from a buy-in standpoint, especially from a tour money standpoint, some seem like they're bigger and more important than others, and they should be weighted accordingly.
I think another thing we can get into, maybe we'll just do it quickly here, JK, but it is becoming clear to me, folks, live bankroll fans, and I'm one of them. If I were a contest player, I would be focusing my energy on live bankroll play if I were afforded the opportunity to play in these events, which as someone who covers it, I don't feel comfortable doing regardless of what the rules say. But for me, it's funny because live bankroll enthusiasts often have like an almost moral high ground about how much better their format is than the mythical one. I have a little bit of a problem with that just because we see it time and again. It seems to me if you don't have the right opinion in the last race of a live bankroll contest, you're not going to win. I think that's true at least 4 out of 5 times. I think it's also true that in almost every live bankroll event, if the last race were a different last race, in other words, flip the 7th and the 9th, this happened to our buddy the Man in Black at Del Mar, if you'd flipped the 7th and the 9th race, he would have won. To me, is that something we should be thinking about a little bit? I mean, is the last race too important, Jonathan, in live bankroll play?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it is. I think that just, you know, we've talked about it before, and I'll, Paul Matisse mentioned it at Saratoga, like after the Saratoga tournament. There's got to be some type of a different game that we can play that can prevent the last race all in desperation move that makes the decision of what's going to happen in the tournament. There's got to be something we can do. We've bounced around some ideas, but at the same time, it's this, you know, like I said with everything else, like everyone's playing under the same rules. So if that's not your comfort zone, then you either need to make it your comfort zone or don't complain about it.
No, I think that's well put. And I don't mean to say that it's some huge problem, etc. I guess my bigger point is, no matter what the format is, there's going to be nuances to it. It's going to favor certain type of players versus others. There's no perfect format. I guess my bigger problem is with people who are just completely denigrate the mythical money about how superior live bank is. I do agree it's more for me, but I just don't think there's any, you need to get on any kind of moral high horse about how better it is, because it's got different ways to approach it and you could even say flaws too. So just a point I wanted to make before we move on from tournaments. Cool announcement from our friends at the NTRA yesterday that the $3 million bonus connecting the NHC and the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge has been expanded. It had already been announced that Joe Applebaum, who won the BCBC, is going to have a shot at the extra $3 million should he win the NHC. Jonathan, I don't even know if you saw this, but it turns out now anyone winning those two tournaments in a row in either order, as long as they were an NTRA Tour member before the Breeders' Cup contest, going to be eligible for a $3 million bonus. Is it likely to be hit? No. But does it add a little excitement, and is it something that'll be fun to cover as somebody who writes about tournaments? Yes. What does it mean to you as a player, Jonathan, the creation of this $3 million bonus?
Well, I'll tell you what, speaking of bonuses, last year I was playing for a bonus, and when I jumped out to the lead, I was booed on the leaderboard. I just dropped my kid off to school, and he went in. He was the last person there, and he was cheered. So hopefully, the generation is going to change. I'm a pretty proud father right now. So
that's awesome.
At least his peers are a little bit happier to see him. It's cool. I mean, I think it's great. I actually was driving today and just thinking in general. Like, if I was a racing secretary, this would be like my new best friend is my insurance guy. And I would just get all of these insurance policies that if you win the Forgo and the whatever, the Vanderbilt and the King's Bishop, you get a $500,000 bonus. If you win the Jim Dandy and the Travers, you get this bonus. If you win the whatever, I would just be bonus full of, my insurance guy would love me. He'd give me a great Christmas present. And I would just have a ton of them. And I think it's really smart because the chance of winning motivates people to participate. And participation helps your bottom line. And so I just think it's a brilliant thing to do. Hopefully it'll happen to someone someday. You know, that's kind of what our sport needs is for that moneymaker moment where someone wins $1 million off of $18. And so, yeah, kudos to him. I mean, look, I don't think it's like the most likely thing in the world, but I also I'm not one of those people that thinks it's a waste of money.
No, I agree with you. It's just the ability to dream on that incredible life-changing score. Like you said, the moneymaker moment. I think it's got a marketing value, and maybe I'm saying this selfishly as someone who covers this stuff, but it's got a marketing value way beyond its specific chance of happening. And hey, you never know. I mean, take a look. I know it didn't happen, but this year we had Dave Gutfreund get so close. We had Charlie Davis get so close to winning both of those events. That's two players who were able to put entries in the top 10 of both of those events. Charlie going quite a bit closer than that. So it's not completely, great. Let me put it this way. And we won't pick up this thought, but crazier things have happened this year, 2016 alone. With that said, let's move on to some horse racing, guys. Mike Hogan, did you have a chance to check out either of the grade ones at Del Mar over the weekend?
Of course.
Well, tell me your thoughts. Let's start with Texas Rhino, a horse who people have. Steve Bick, I know, is maybe the chief cheerleader of Texas Rhino this year, getting the job done in the Turf Cup. What did you think of the performance?
Wasn't that last week? The two grade ones that I was thinking of were the Hollywood Derby with Annals of Time and the Matriarch with Miss Temple City.
You're absolutely right. I had a little bit of a brain moment there. We've got the technology working. We have a host fail. Instead, we never did talk about Texas Wayne. We had to cross on him.
We didn't, but we could. Yes. I saw that race as well.
Start there.
I think that
wasn't
was a race.
Grade one, even, I should say. So you another fail on my part. That was two, I believe.
That's okay. You threw me a huge curve there. I was absolutely ready to talk about this weekend's races. I was not expecting to talk about last weekend's. But I saw the race, and Texas Rhino is a nice horse who's been progressing well. And, on paper and in both in the previous race in the Breeders' Cup Turf, he looked to be maybe not quite as good as Ashley Love Sugar. Ashley Love Sugar had the first run, but Texas Rhino swooped right on by him. Maybe we've got a nice improving horse who could be a big player in those turf races out on the West Coast.
We talk a lot about the sort of grade one plus concept and how there are some horses who maybe on the biggest day find themselves a little overmatched. I think that goes to quite possibly for Miss Temple City. Not that she's not a legitimate grade one horse. She is. But you know, a spot like the Breeders' Cup, kind of tricky, gets down a little bit out of the stratosphere this past weekend, and the result a lot different. What did you think of her?
Boy, it was a really good race, and it was a very well-timed ride by Edgar Prado, who's quietly been having, and I tweeted it out, I don't know if you guys saw, but he's quietly been having a little bit of a resurgence. He's won something like 18 or 19% of his graded stakes over the last couple of years. From a betting standpoint, you almost doubled your money if you bet on every one of Edgar's mounts in graded stakes the last couple of years. And it's just nice to see a good jockey like that getting back after a few kind of rough years. But as far as the horse goes, you're right, Pete. I mean, if it wasn't for Tepin, we might be looking at the turf female of the year. I mean, she's danced all the dances. She's won some big races. She's traveled. She's competed against the boys, and she hasn't been disgraced in those races. She's a good one, and I think they're talking about Ascot again for her.
They did. I did see a note about Ascot. Perhaps another invitation to sit with the Queen for the folks from Sagamore. But that'll be terrific. I might have to try to get back to Royal Ascot in 2017 if the fates allow. That'd be a lot of fun. Podcast fans were abuzz Saturday night when the Annals of Time got the job done. Hopefully some listeners were able to make some money on that one. A pretty strong opinion for both JK and myself. Mike, did you come around? I know you liked Hayabusa 1 in there. Were you able to make any hay with Annals of Time as well?
I didn't go too deeply, but I did play a pick 4 where I used Annals of Time as well and singled the Baffert firster who won the following race. So part of what convinced me was the case that you guys made. I felt like it was a really wide open race prior to the running of the race, but after the race, I felt like Annals of Time was by far the best. And another nice, improving, somewhat lightly raced horse that it looks like he's going to be a huge player next year.
JK, I'll bring you in to talk about Annals of Time. How good do you think this one is?
I was impressed. You know, I mean, it, like we mentioned on Friday, just to put in your handicapping notebook, something that I told you guys that I had picked up just as early as this year with Duke Matisse, is that, you know, when you find these horses that are running figures as two-year-olds that fit with three-year-olds, expect them to be able to find a little bit more. Maybe they had some excuses, and he's a perfect example of it. I mean, he had that huge number, then he had the brakes. He's clearly had an issue that they had to resolve, and he shows up in a grade one with two other runners that look very likely for the same trainer. You know, it's one of those where if you wish you could go back again, you would make a little bit more money.
Kudos to you too, JK, on the excellent trip note about Annals of Time, maybe not being ridden as hard as some of the other runners in the previous spot. Between the fact that he seemed a little bit more progressive because of the late start, and also that trip note, seemed very easy for him to find that length and get the job done. And I'm happy to have heard via Twitter that a lot of our podcast listeners had that one. Folks who are maybe new to the show, maybe some folks finding us for the first time today through Facebook Live. Typically the way it works is Tuesday's more of a free form discussion. We talk a little bit about issues in the game, about the previous weekend's races. The Friday show, we do a little bit of that too, but we also look forward typically to the public handicapper races. New contest just started on publichandicapper.com. It's absolutely free and well worth checking out for anybody out there. JK, before we move on to sort of the darker side of what went down at Del Mar over the course of last weekend, did you have any other thoughts on any of the racing recently that we haven't covered, whether it's Miss Temple City, Texas Rhino, or anybody else?
No, I thought the comments after the race with Val Dori were interesting. You know, the Mike was kind of bullish in the interview afterwards about how she's progressing and how good she thinks she's going to be. And I know Baffert's always thought she's going to be a good horse. I believe she's the mare they got from, that was sent over from Dubai, and so obviously had some different racing style to kind of get used to, and different climate and, you know, surroundings and everything. Seems like she might be one to pop in the stable mail just to be a fan of. I'm not sure if we're going to get great prices on her moving forward, but she could be one that could kind of pop up and emerge in a distaff class that lost some of its big stars.
I thought the Smith quote was fascinating. It was almost him saying how much he doubted her previously and how she'd sort of grown up, come into her own. Reminded me a little bit, just a little bit, of that discussion we had many moons ago now, in probably episode 6 of the podcast, about a horse named Honor Code who showed some signs of insecurity, and then the young Padawan came back a Jedi. Perhaps this is a situation like that. Did either of you guys hear about any future plans for Valdori?
Well, I haven't. I should look. I could look on DRF.com. I'm sure Mr. Privman or Mr. Anderson has written a recap of the race, and there's probably a Baffert quote in there somewhere.
All right. Well, let's move on to the difficult thing we have to talk about. Mike, I thought you did an amazing job writing about this very sensitive and frankly ugly situation that arose at Del Mar on Sunday night. JK, you and I haven't even talked about this yet, but for those of you who aren't, a lot of podcast listeners are not necessarily industry buffs the way we are. Mike, why don't you talk to people about what happened out there?
Yeah, you know, boy, it's giving a little background on the bet for those that maybe aren't 100% sure what happened. The $2 pick six has been the standard at both Southern California tracks as well as New York tracks for a while. And, you know, some other tracks have gone to the jackpot format. But in doing so, what they do two major changes to what the $2 pick six as it plays out in California and New York. The traditional jackpot pick sixes have a lot lower minimum wager, often and usually 20 cents. They also never pay out on consolation tickets, 5 of 6, if someone else hits 6 of 6. So if no one hits 6 of 6, then they'll pay out 5 of 6 in those jackpot ones. But if there's even one 6 of 6 winner, the 5 of 6 get nothing. But that makes some sense because there's such a lower barrier to entry. It's 1/10 the cost to get in for a minimum. So players that are familiar with those jackpot wagers understand that. Del Mar wanted to do something similar to the jackpot wagers, but they didn't want to lower, they didn't want to change their pick six too much. So what they came up with was keep the $2 pick six after takeout, which stayed the same as during the summer meet. After takeout, 70% goes back to the winners, which is exactly what happened prior. And that of that remaining 30%, which normally would go back to the 5 of 6 consolation tickets, half of it, so 15%, goes back to the 5 of 6, and 15% goes into a carryover pool if there's not a single winning ticket that day. And that's how they fund the jackpot. So what I think happened is they came up with this idea. They said it's a great idea. Of course, they had to run it by the legal folks to get it approved. And in doing so, they used some placeholder verbiage from a rule of the American Racing Commission. I don't remember the
international?
Full international about these types of jackpot wagers. And I won't go through the full details, but the long and short of it, from my understanding, is that placeholder verbiage talks about no consolations being paid out, which is normal for every other jackpot wager aside from what Del Mar was trying to create here. And it was saying that they don't pay out to consolations if there is 6 of 6 hit, which is normal for Golden Gate, Gulfstream,
the 10-cent version for the 20-cent version of the bet. As you explained before, that makes sense. $2 version of the bet would seem to maybe call for a different policy.
Well, and that's how it had been through the whole fall meet, the 14 days of the meet. If you were playing at 5 of 6, you got paid 15% of the total pool of the consolation. So it wasn't as much as you would have gotten paid on those 5 of 6 tickets in the summer when it was 30%, but you still received something. So what happened was, what I think happened was, they did this, they set it in place, they knew what they wanted, but the verbiage in the legal copy, nobody went back to review it and update what would happen on the very real and 100% guaranteed event of a mandatory payout. i.e., which is when there is more than one 6 of 6 ticket and when there will be no carryover pool. What happens then? Does 70% go to the winning tickets like has done on every other day? And the 5 of 6 split 30%, which is more than they'd split on the previous? Does 85% go to the winning 6 of 6 tickets and the 5 of 6 go, do they essentially get all of what was held for the jackpot? Or does that 15% get split evenly among the 6 of 6, the 5 of 6? Do they do 10 and 5? Nobody talked through the scenario. So nobody ever really was ready for what happened on Sunday, which was 100% of the pool went back to the 6 of 6 tickets.
Without any announcement being made, like Mike said, nobody thought it through. You have a lot of people there expecting to get their 5 out of 6. I mean, it's not good, man. I mean, this is something that, especially given that they're not even citing their own California rules, the CHRB rules. Now, maybe the CHRB rules have a line in there that says anything not covered defaults to the racing commissioner's guidelines, but those ARCI rules are really just supposed to be guidelines for people to write and codify their own rules state by state. But let's put aside whether or not they have a legal right to do what they did. As a horse player, frankly, I just think it stinks to have the expectation among your customers that this is going to be that you're paying 5 of 6, and then to pull that out from under without making any sort of deal about it beforehand seems very clear to me that the 5 should have been paid out. And then, in my mind, to make matters worse, to put out a statement Sunday night that says, hey, hold on to those tickets, and then come back and say, oh, we're not going to pay it. To me, that seems like the worst sort of CYA that you could imagine, where they were clearly spending hours thinking, hey, do we legally have to do this? Let's put aside for a second what you legally have to do. Let's talk about what's right to do. And this from a place that arguably took 6 figures worth of commissions in a very specious way, very recently because of the drainage pad incident that we discussed ad nauseum, for the same shop to then come back within a couple of weeks and deny the 5s to be paid. I just thought it was nuts. Jonathan, what is your opinion on this?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, it's one of those deals where I didn't participate. I don't even know why. I guess I was traveling. I wasn't paying attention. I didn't participate. I probably would have felt a little bit more passionate about it if I was involved. I think as an organization, you have to understand when a mistake was made, and I think that your customer will appreciate you much more and will be willing to continue their patronage if you try to correct the mistake. And the problem is that I would imagine that from a budget standpoint, when they did their budget for the fall meet, they anticipated that they would have this carryover situation on the last day and blah, 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 blah. And it was a significant dollar amount for them to have to try to rectify. Probably also, like we had talked about in passing, PETA, a tote issue. Like how do you even decide or figure out what this is worth? And then the line of people that you're going to have, they're going to come up and say, I had 5 of 6 and I ripped my ticket up. What are you going to do? You know, it's just,
I think that's a small price to pay. I think that's a small price to pay for trying to do the right thing. Clearly, by saying hang on to the tickets, you're going to have some people listen to that. Most of the people playing in this pool are going to be sharp enough to know that it's weird and hold on. Yeah, there's going to be tickets thrown away, and those people aren't going to get anything. But isn't doing something better than doing nothing?
Oh, no, 100%. I guess my statement was more of a devil's advocate. I guess this is what they were thinking.
Gotcha.
If it was me, I would take it as an unbelievable PR move to stand up and say, we made a mistake, but we value our horse players. We appreciate our horse players, and this is what we're prepared to do. We're going to go ahead and pay out 5 of 6 on a consolation ticket of $300 for each 5 of 6 that you have. That's going to total, you know, so-and-so such amount of money. You know, we're going to lose a little bit of takeout. Because here's the thing. I would say if there's 500 5 of 6 tickets out there, only 300 of them are going to get cashed. You know, 200 of them are in trash cans somewhere. So you come out and say this really nice statement about how you're going to support the horse players, and it's really not going to affect you as much as the statement might suggest that it's going to. And then you're the applaud. You know, you're going to get a lot of applause from horse players around the world and for taking care of the horse player. But instead, it's the opposite.
Mike, in your piece, you advocated for something very similar to what JK is talking about. Is it too late? Has the horse left the barn on this one? Or is there any chance of Del Mar stepping in and doing the right thing here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's too late for them to step up and do the right thing. In fact, the piece that I posted came out after the ruling and the announcement that they were not going to be paying the 506. I still think there's time. And I agree with JK that this is a case where I think, based on the timeline, and I said it in the piece, even the Del Mar officials were surprised that the consolations didn't get paid out after the final race on Sunday. And if you go back to what the goal was for creating this new jackpot pick six, why even make a change in the first place? They were trying to create interest and create excitement and create new fans of the bet and lure people back to a pick six wager that had maybe lost a little luster and maybe lost a little bit to the pick five or pick four. So I don't have the numbers, but my understanding is the handle generally bore that out. And until the last race went official on Sunday, it was, you know, deemed by, in their view, a successful change. And by not making it clear what was going to happen, I don't even think they knew what was going to happen, but by not making good on something that the bettors had expected and received for the first 14 days of the meet, but did not receive on the 15th, then you do leave a lot of negative opinion and bad taste in bettors' mouth. And it's a chance, I think, if they're able to step up, find the budget somehow, make good on those 5 of 6 tickets, you turn a negative into a positive and you say, look, we weren't even expecting this. We are sorry that it happened, and we want to do everything we can to make sure people feel like they're being looked out for and taken care of. And so this is what we're going to do, whether it's 100,000, whether it's the full takeout. I don't know, but I think that there is still time for them to do something, and I think that they should. Otherwise, it makes me sad to see some progress that maybe had been made on their part, and then some, you know, a huge step back.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine what would happen in Las Vegas. A grade one gambling game takes care of this problem. No question about it in my mind. Do we want to be a grade one gambling game? We have the potential to be the greatest gambling game in the world, but stuff like this just doesn't make us look good, and it doesn't make people happy about spending their money. But I like your optimism, Mike. Maybe it's not too late. Let's root for the right thing to happen here. All right, and now for something completely different. We've talked about policy. We've talked about tournaments today, a little bit of racing. I kind of messed that up, but we got some in there. Now I want to talk about Adriana Lima. JK, do you know who that is?
Yeah, it's part of my childhood.
Adriana Lima, a renowned supermodel. Why is she coming up on a horse racing podcast? Well, a guy, I want to call him a friend, but he's not really a friend. I don't know him personally. He's just, we follow each other on Twitter, and I'm a fan of his work. A guy by the name of Jeff Perlman tweeted out this video. I'll retweet it. I've been hesitant to retweet it because it just doesn't seem to have to do with anything else on my feed. What it is, basically, is a little video of Adriana Lima walking a runway. And as I was watching this video, degenerate that I am, the thought that comes to mind, nothing impure, it's about horse racing. And what it was watching Adriana Lima walk this runway was the answer to one of the most frequently asked questions I get at the track when I'm down by the paddock looking at horses walk by. And people will say, oh, what are you looking for? And watching this video, it was like, in all seriousness, a lot of the same attributes. You see this person, physical specimen, clearly athletic, walking with great confidence, full of herself, in fine fettle. To me, it's the human equivalent of Zenyatta doing that little dance she would do before her races. And I'm going to hang on to this video. And the next time somebody asks me, what do you look for in the paddock? I'm just going to show them that and save the words and focus on if the two has kidney sweat while they're walking by and save myself the trouble. Mike, I know you're not like a huge paddock guy, but I know you do appreciate what a good horse looks like. Do you think there's any merit in this, or am I just making a crazy analogy to talk 5 minutes on a podcast here?
Boy, I think you maybe are making a crazy analogy to talk 5 minutes on a podcast at the risk of coming across as a little bit of a creepy old man. but I don't know. I haven't seen the video. I would say, why not just show them Zenyatta walking around in the paddock and doing her little dance?
Fair enough. Fair enough. JK, anything here?
Well, let's see here. I'm a fan. So like I said, there's a big part of my childhood. I think I discovered her when I was probably 16 years old. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, an old racetrack guy told me one time, and since we're tightroping being offensive, he really did tell me, he's like, you want your horses like you want your women, like happy, in a good mood, ready to go out, energetic, bouncing around, ready to, you know, whatever. You don't want, like, in a bad mood, upset, you know, pouty. You don't want to deal with that. And I, for the women that are listening, I'm sure you would like your man to be the same way. So
right, I don't think it doesn't have to be a gender or sex specific thing. I think that the sort of positive energy, in control, and I think that certain little bit of being full of yourself is something that a lot of us men and women, gay, straight, want in our partners. I think that's completely fair.
100%.
All right, there you have it. We had some questions come in this week. We always encourage folks to either hit us up on Twitter. We'll do a quick run of the Twitter handles. I'm at Looms Boldly. Mike is at DRF Hogan. Jonathan is at UT Big Hair. You can hit us up on Twitter for questions. You can also send in questions to podcast@drf.com. And we had one from friend of the podcast, Mitchell Foote. And it's a very hard question to answer because he was asking very specifically about bet amounts and how much you should bet in certain situations. I'll take the first crack at it, and then we'll see what the guys have to say. But for me, it's all relative to what your bankroll is. You know, you can't just say, oh, bet $100 on this, bet $20 on this. To me, and maybe this is the eat your vegetables of handicapping advice, but I'm sorry, it's true. I really believe that to be effective, you need to have a separate bankroll that's your gambling money. That could be, for a new player, as it was with me for many years, a couple $100s. It could be in the thousands or more. But the idea of having money set aside that's not the same money as the money you're going out to dinner with or paying your rent with, but money that is devoted to gambling. And then I would look at different opportunities in terms of percentage of your bankroll. And also, you have to look at the big picture in terms of, is this like my bankroll, like this is all I got for the year, or is this my bankroll until I replenish it? If it's your bankroll for the year, you're going to want to keep the percentage of what you're betting of that bankroll pretty darn low. I would recommend, if it's money that, if that's it, you know, you're going to want to be looking for preservation reasons at maybe betting 2% of that bank. If it's something that, you know, you could come to the end of it and have another conversation, maybe you want it to be 5% of your bank. And then I think you want to be betting, you know, towards the high end of that scale when the opportunities are the best, whatever you do best as a horse player, which you should know, speaking of eating your vegetables from keeping records and things like that, towards the 5% end. And if it's maybe an action bet, it probably should be 1% of that total amount. So that's how I look at those situations, Mitchell. I don't know, guys, if either of you have any specific advice about how much to bet and how you determine that amount. Mike, we'll start with you.
Well, and I think Mitchell's question was specifically about how much to bet on a Saturday or Sunday, maybe if you're just focusing on one or two days out of the week. And what I would say is, yeah, determine that bankroll, whatever it is, and maybe it's even a bankroll for that particular day. You know, certainly, you know, Pete's suggestion to do it for the whole year is very financially sound. But even if even if you just figure out, okay, this is going to be my bankroll for the whole day, then let it go back to what your strongest opinions are. And if your strongest opinion is this one horse in the sixth race is going to provide a lot of value and I think is a very likely winner at a price that I'm expecting to get, then craft wagers around that opinion, especially if you're able to connect it with a second opinion, which is a favorite in an earlier race is vulnerable, or the favorite in that race is vulnerable, so I'll play them out of the verticals. That is where I like to use my bankroll. And then what I will do is, depending upon my bankroll for that day, put a certain percentage, whatever I feel comfortable with, the 50% even, around wagers covering that race. Maybe it's only 20%. Depends on the day, depends on the bankroll. But that's how I approach things. I usually focus on my biggest opinions first and then build my wagers accordingly and bankroll as such.
That makes a lot of sense to me, Mike. And I think if you're on a tight bankroll, I would recommend, just from a gambling theory point of view, let's say you have $100 to bet on a Saturday. What I would say from a gambling theory wise, rather than spread that out, if you're already dealing with a little bit of a short stacked amount, I'd pick one spot. I'd find one race that you can bet properly with that whole amount rather than trying to bet 10 races, $10 each, which could be fun and maybe is worth doing if you're learning and trying to get experience to learn. But if you're that person, I'd tell you on that type of a limit to get into tournament play, where you can get a lot more handicapping done and have a ton of action than just going so small through dribbing and drabbing throughout the course of a day. JK, how do you decide how much to bet?
This is probably my my biggest. I don't even mind saying it. It's probably my biggest issue is understanding. Kind of having a plan of action for a majority of my life. I didn't really have a plan. I just kind of just went with it. And
that's what most people do.
To be fair, I've had enough success that it kind of cushioned a lot of the mistakes that I made, and, you know, with being too aggressive or not having a plan, not keeping good records, not sticking within my daily limit or weekly limit or whatever. I got away with it a majority of the time because I've done so well. But there's been times, obviously, where it's created some pressure that I think can all be avoided if you're honest with yourself about understanding that you need to record keep. If you don't record keep or you don't want to record keep, it's probably because you don't want to know the truth. Or you know that the truth is a little bit unacceptable. So, you know, I'm not trying to be dark with anyone, but you need to, you know, you need a record keep.
Yeah.
The other thing is that you need to understand what your limit is and respect those limits and whatever they are. And the only way that you can really set a limit, in my opinion, is to kind of forecast your day or your week or your month. And to have an understanding. And like Pete said, I think having a gambling bankroll and a life bankroll are two different things, because I think for a lot of people, and it's happened to me in the past, your $500 gambling bankroll that disappeared when you were loaded down on the rail with a bad trip turns into you dip into that $500 dinner bankroll. And so I think you should have to be careful and really be honest with yourself about it. And make sure that you do some good planning. And Pete's working on a project right now. I think it's going to change the way we look at things that is really informative on ways to do that and not to allow it to affect your life, your relationships in a negative way.
That's a great answer, JK. Let me get down to brass tacks just to answer Mitchell's question a little more specifically. Once you have a bankroll established for a day, how do you go about picking what amount to bet?
I mean, like, I'm like you. If I have a kind of a free range budget, like a budget where I feel like I can really attack different spots
in a way that I feel good about it, where I'm actually putting in the money that I want to put in, like for a Kentucky Derby day, a Breeders' Cup day, where I'm coming in well equipped. If it's a random Saturday and I'm going to bet, you know, $200 or $500 or whatever it is, I would prefer to spend a majority of my money in a pool that I feel comfortable with or an opinion that I feel strongly about. For instance, if I'm going to Del Mar for the day and I got $500, the chances are I'm going to probably bet $400 on the early pick five if I like how the pick five looks, because I feel like that's the best bet. I feel like the way that I handicap that creates the best opportunities. And I feel like the way that my mind works, I want to just focus on one thing rather than, you know, be desperately trying to figure out a way to make money through nine races throughout the day. Save that $100 if I get beat, find a spot that I like later and try to get back involved. The other way, or if there's a horse I've just been dying to bet that's running in the seventh, then I'm going to look to hook him up with doubles or pick threes around him. Or if there's something I love intra race, I'll just bet it right there. But essentially, it's find the pool or the opinion that you feel the strongest about, and I would attack it in that situation when you're coming in with like a limited bankroll. If you're coming in with a stronger bankroll, then just fire away in the spots that you feel. But most people don't go to the track like that.
No, it's a good way of looking at the world, I think, JK. Mike, anything to add to those specifics from Jonathan, or do you feel like we've covered this one?
No, I think what Jonathan said at the last part of it is exactly spot on, and that's how I approach it as well.
Great, and I think we're going to be talking a little bit more maybe on one of our winter shows about this record-keeping issue. Folks out there, let us know also. We have a little more time during this part of the year to get into these in-depth discussions. We're also going to be bringing you some really cool interviews. I think we haven't even talked to you about this, JK, but do you like that idea? Each of us will go out, we'll do some interviewing and bring that audio back here to play on the show. Is there anybody in the racing world you've been dying to talk to?
Yeah, sure. I can think of some. I mean, I can think of a bunch of people that I'd love to talk to. Yeah, no, that'd be definitely fun.
So yeah, that could definitely be a good thing coming up. And let us know out there, folks, people you want us to talk to. We are going to, I think, be able to have Richard Migliori on an upcoming pod. That's going to be fun. That might be one where we all want to do the interview, because I don't see any of us not wanting to have the chance to talk to the Mig, great jockey and broadcaster that he is. But all right, we got a few more minutes left on the show. We did have another question, but I'm not finding it. Did you either of you guys have anything in your inboxes for us to chat about in the 8 minutes we have left on the show today?
Well, we can chat about something that I put out on Twitter yesterday, which was a poll. It's a 3-day poll, so there's a couple days left as we're talking right now. There's almost 2 days left on the poll. If you're listening to this after the fact, it might still be up. But, you know, looking ahead to the Eclipse Awards, many of the Eclipse Awards are already determined, but I think one of the ones that's pretty wide open is the jockey one. And so I figured that two of the three finalists would be Javier Castellano and Jose Ortiz, both having amazing years. And so I put out a poll as to who that third finalist should be. And I put out Florent Giroux, Ayrton Ortiz Jr., or Mike Smith as the third options. I also said, or another. There might be another that I'm not thinking of. I don't know if you guys want to weigh in on that, if we want to just put that out there for listener opinion and come back to it on a later show. But
Not looking at any numbers, the one that popped in my head, not that any of them aren't there, it's kind of tough because they're all sort of deserving of being a finalist, but hasn't Mike Smith won a whole lot of grade ones this year?
Well, he has. Here's the knock on Mike Smith. Mike Smith is only a part-time rider. I think he's only had like 400 mounts or so.
That's going to be tough. Yeah, that's going to be tough. But the grade one situation is, I mean, has anybody won more grade ones than him? Do you have that?
I don't have the grade ones. I have graded stakes. He's won 21 graded stakes, which is three more than Ayrton has won. But yeah, he's only got 324 mounts on the year. You compare that to Jose Ortiz, who's pushing close to 1,500.
Yeah, it's probably not going to happen. That was just my first, you know, you go with your, that was my blink test answer to the question. JK, what do you think?
Well, you know, what's funny is when you think about the voting of it, I mean, obviously Jose and Javier will be, you know, two of the finalists. A lot of people voting, I think, would have a hard time putting no offense to the other guys, but have a hard time putting some of those other guys who don't really have a shot of winning versus Mike, who I'm pretty sure has won more Grade Ones this year than anyone else. I mean, he won four at Saratoga. Four Grade Ones at Saratoga. You know, he won what, two Breeders' Cup races.
I think just put him on there to be the one. It's going to be one of the other two. So put that name on there for folks that want to use that other criteria. You know, it's one of those things where we can talk about these awards, and sometimes it's silly to talk about who's going. I'm not saying that it was a bad thing to bring up, Mike. I think it's an interesting conversation, but it comes down to, like, we're debating who's going to run third, right?
I mean, to some extent, yeah. But I think it partly gets at what the voters reward. Is it Florent Giroux, for instance, who has had success? I counted. He's had graded stakes wins, 30 graded stakes wins in 2016 at 15 different tracks. So do you reward that, or do you reward Mike Smith, who's had more Grade One success, certainly, but he rides maybe a quarter of the races and rarely travels outside of Southern California except to ride the biggest races with, you know, the Eclipse Award winning horses, you know, the Songbirds, the Arrogates. He doesn't bother taking Zia Park on their big day, whereas Florent does. Or do you give credit to a jockey like Irid, who's winning at a very, very high percentage and winning a lot of graded stakes, but doing it primarily on one circuit, albeit maybe the toughest circuit in the country? That's partly why I did it, was less about who's going to run third, but more about what is it that you value.
I like it. What's your answer to the question, Mike?
Gut check without doing full research. I kind of lean towards Florent. He goes everywhere. He doesn't have, you know, unlike Irid, who has been riding a lot of good stakes winners for Chad Brown, who's having a phenomenal year. Florent's been riding for a bunch of different trainers. He doesn't have as many of the big name horses as a lot of them. He's riding at the smaller tracks as well. He's making trips all around the country. And he's winning at a very high percentage in the big races as well. I kind of lean towards him, but I don't know. I'm not locked in yet.
You buying that, JK? You buying that argument for Flo?
I like Doug. I like Doug Bradhaar a lot. So,
Flo's agent.
I mean, I get it. Neither one of them are gonna. It's like you said. It's a great discussion, and I don't have a problem having it. It's just it's hard for me to get too motivated to really make a selection when one of the other two is going to win. You know,
sure.
Jose Ortiz. Well, I mean, I noticed on Twitter yesterday, and I noticed last week in an embarrassing way. I noticed, but he's riding at Parks on the dark days in New York. It's like, that dude's a machine. He had a picture of him driving his Audi down to Parks.
In traffic.
It's pretty impressive when you can see a young kid like that be so dedicated to being the best at what they're doing and to work hard and to not cut corners, you know. He could easily sit back and relax. He just won Saratoga's meet this summer. He could hang out and do just fine, but the fact that he's going down there and riding horses at Parks on a Monday is pretty impressive.
It's fun. For all that we say about jockeys, it is also fun when you get to see them at the peak of their powers, and it's fun to see them have glory days runs, like we got to see from Edgar Prado at Del Mar last weekend, winning a couple races for Graham Motion. Production meeting at the end of the show, Mike, we didn't talk about this before. I imagine it doesn't really matter for Tuesday, but for our Friday shows, to clear the way for Matt Bernier and the Matt Bernier show, should we get in the habit of wrapping at about 11:58? What did you and the production crew discuss this at all?
We haven't discussed it. I think that we will still be doing that. Yes, we absolutely will be teeing it up for Matt. It may or may not be live on Facebook. It certainly will be live on Spreaker and then available after the fact. But we want to make sure we're not when we cut and then after us, if you're listening live, go to drf.com, watch Matt, go to Facebook, Daily Racing Forum, watch Matt. I think that makes sense.
Excellent. That's right. I forgot. Facebook Live is going to be for the Tuesday shows for the time being, and then we're going to reevaluate. We will be live on Spreaker on Friday at 11. That will be the next time you hear from us. So I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Mike Hogan. I want to thank all of you for listening, especially those of you who have taken the time to leave reviews on iTunes. It helps other people find us, helps the show. We appreciate that very much. We will be back on Friday at 11. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.